rise. Iran calls on the IAEA to inspect Israel's nuclear sites, saying the regime's blatant threats to use nuclear weapons must not be tolerated by the international community. Israel cancels family visits for all Palestinian prisoners this month as a collective punishment after the escape of six Palestinians from a high-security prison. Also, the Taliban agreed to let 200 American civilians and third country nationals who remained in Afghanistan after the end of the U.S. evacuation operation leave. Hello and welcome from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you for joining us. Beginning with our top story, Iran's permanent representative to the United Nations says nuclear disarmament must remain a top priority for the world. Majid Takhravanchi urged the international community to press nuclear weapon states to fulfill their legal obligations under the Non-Proliferation or Proliferation Treaty. The Iranian diplomat singled out the United States for having conducted over 1,000 nuclear tests since 1945. He also said Israel's possession of weapons of mass destruction and its threats to use them must not be tolerated. Takhravanchi made the remarks at the high-level plenary meeting of the UN General Assembly on the International Day Against Nuclear Tests. Yemen's health officials say at least 100 health facilities have stopped offering services due to fuel shortage. They blame the shortage on Saudi Arabia, saying the kingdom's imposed siege on the impoverished nation has hampered daily life in Yemen. Abdul Latif Al-Washili has more in this report.
The healthcare system in Yemen is deteriorating due to the ongoing Saudi blockade that has led to a harsh shortage of fuel. Sana Health Bureau said 100 health facilities had to stop providing health services partially or completely due to their inability to generate power anymore.
The fuel cuts in our country due to the blockade and aggression have affected the ability of health facilities to provide the necessary health services to our people. Our hospital has been negatively affected so that we have no way but to increase the charge of our services, and this constitutes an additional burden on Yemenis, especially amid the war and siege.
A civilian maternal hospital in Yemen's capital Sana'a used to have 45,000 liters of diesel each month as a grant from the World Health Organization. However, the world body, the hospital said, has stopped its fuel grant due to what it says financial problems.
We are Sabreen Hospital in Sana'a. It is the referral hospital for maternity and the childhood disease. We are before we received oil from the WHO. During 2021, the amount of the oil received to the hospital is become decreased to the fourth. The amount already we receive it. It is big catastrophe. It will lead to the death of the many child and woman, especially that admitted in the ICU, in the nursery, and the OT. Here in the hospital, we decrease most of our services to decrease the use of the electricity.
Earlier, Yemen's petroleum company said only three oil ships were allowed to arrive at Hudaydah port since the beginning of 2021, covering only 3% of what is required to fulfill the basic needs of Yemenis. The Saudi war and the blockade have led Yemen to the world's worst humanitarian crisis, according to the United Nations.
Yemen's healthcare system is on the verge of collapse as a result of the years-long Saudi war and the blockade. Yemenis also blame the United Nations for their suffering, saying the world body should take real measures against the continued Saudi violations of their rights. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The U.S. says the Taliban have agreed to allow some 200 American civilians and third country nationals who remained in Afghanistan following the August 31st deadline to leave the country. An American official said on the condition of anonymity that the Taliban were pressed to allow the departures by U.S. Special Representative in Afghanistan, Zalmay Khalilzad. The departures are expected on Thursday. The official, however, did not say whether the U.S. and third country nationals were among people stranded for days in Mazar-e-Sharif because their private charters had not been allowed to depart. In an agreement signed in February 2020, the U.S. agreed to withdraw all of its forces from the country by the end of August. Earlier, we were joined by our correspondent Amin Alemi in Kabul, who gave us more details regarding the evacuation of the remaining U.S. and other countries' nationals from Afghanistan.
According to Taliban sources, they have allowed some 200 American nationals to leave Afghanistan via Kabul International Airport here in the Afghan capital, Kabul. American sources also say that we are committed to further negotiate with the Taliban in order to get permission for evacuation of all American citizens as well as all Afghan nationals who had worked with them over the past 20 years. In the meantime, this comes as the Taliban had stopped at least four aircraft that had the aircrafts had planned to evacuate American nationals and Afghan nationals from Mazar-e-Sharif Airport in northern Afghanistan. However, the Taliban sources also say that in addition to the evacuation of these 200 Americans from Afghan from Afghanistan's Kabul International Airport, they are allowed to evacuate the rest of European passport holders and green card holders from Kabul International Airport today, that is Thursday.
Afghanistan's acting prime minister has called on former government officials to return to the country. In an interview with Al Jazeera, Mullah Muhammad Hassan Akhund promised amnesty for anyone who has worked alongside the United States and the former pro-U.S. government. Akhund also said that the caretaker government would guarantee the security of diplomats, embassies, and humanitarian organizations. He added that the Taliban seek positive and strong relations with the world. The comments came a day after the Taliban announced their interim government. Political commentator Mohammed Dawood Meraki says the Taliban believe Afghanistan belongs to all its citizens.
The Taliban have announced general amnesty that includes everyone from top to bottom, and have mentioned that this country belongs to everyone. Everyone can come and participate in the reconstruction and the building of Afghanistan. Ironically, with the last few soldiers when they remained in Afghanistan prior to their departure, of course, they had announced that there was a type of free-for-all trip for the U.S. So Afghans, it's not a political issue here. People should be concerned about Afghanistan, the Afghan people. Whether they agree with Taliban or not, that shouldn't be an issue. That's, they should be concerned about the well-being of their people, and I think everyone should contribute.
Japan has extended emergency COVID-19 prevention restrictions in the capital, Tokyo, and some other regions until the end of this month. The move is aimed at containing infections and preventing hospitals from being overwhelmed. Japan has been struggling with a fifth wave of the pandemic. Last month, the country extended its long-running curbs until the 12th of September to cover about 80% of its population. However, the number of severe cases and the strain on the medical system has not eased sufficiently in Tokyo and its surrounding areas. Nevertheless, there are some signs of improvement around the nation. Two prefectures out of 21 will move from the state of emergency to more targeted restrictions. A number of other prefectures will also remove all curbs. Iran and Cuba have hit out at the U.S. for tightening sanctions that are hampering their efforts to tackle the COVID crisis. At an international conference in Vienna, parliamentarians from across the world agreed that unilateral policies are blocking attempts to control the virus through concerted global action. Homolesky reports.
Speakers of parliament from around the world gather in Vienna to focus on the most urgent matter of the day, the COVID pandemic.
Most participants concluded the world has not shown competency in dealing with the COVID pandemic, with unilateral policies blocking the vital multilateralism required for joint research and the fair distribution of vaccines.
Iran is among those hardest hit by the pandemic, and the country's visiting MPs say U.S. sanctions are hampering efforts to control the virus.
The unjust sanctions that the U.S. has imposed on Iran have made us unable to import medicines and medical supplies or to take action to remedy the current situation in the country. We need to create fair and equal conditions for all even if it's solely for the sake of controlling the virus.
Cuba was another country that complained about U.S. sanctions.
The U.S. government has been tightening the embargo that is throttling us. Even food and medicines are being kept out, and vital medical supplies are withheld.
Azerbaijan criticized the fact that some countries are stocking up on far more vaccines than their actual needs, while poorer nations are left behind. In Yemen, said the country's representative, people live amidst war, poverty, and hunger, and need vaccines as well as international assistance. To produce one kind of vaccine, the conference was told, a manufacturing company needs ingredients from 19 different countries. No one country can do this alone. So why is the technology not being shared? All hopes lie with the vaccination campaign, but will economic incentives continue to override humanitarian ones? Homolesky, Vienna.
China has slammed the United States for sailing a warship through the South China Sea, calling it a violation of its sovereignty and security. In a statement, the Chinese military called the move illegal and ironclad evidence of Washington's hegemony and militarization of the strategic waters. The U.S. dismissed the accusations by calling them false and excessive. The U.S. guided missile destroyer USS Benfold sailed near the Spratly Islands on Wednesday, just a few days after China imposed new identification rules that apply to the disputed body of water. China claims the South China Sea in its entirety. However, some of its neighbors have also overlapping claims, and the U.S. sides with Beijing's rivals in the dispute. Author and columnist Einar Tangen says there is an inescapable irony regarding the U.S. moves and policies in the South China Sea.
It's losing patience. There does not seem to be a constructive dialogue. This idea that the U.S. is there to protect a treaty, UNCLOS, which is not a part of, deliberately would not sign it because they would not adhere to the idea that there could be any impingement on its sovereignty, is now insisting that it has the right to impose UNCLOS on other sovereign nations. The irony is inescapable. But it has not stopped the U.S., which continues to try to provoke this. There's some feeling that they are trying to keep tensions on a knife edge without going over. This type of kind of gumboat diplomacy is fraught with danger. China's had 40 years of success. During that same 40-year period, the U.S. has gone sideways in so many ways, in some ways backwards. In terms of social policies, African Americans, civil rights, and now even voting. So at this juncture, China's success is an existential threat to the U.S. because the U.S. believes that there is only one way of governance. It is a liberal, democratic capitalism.
The southeastern U.S. state of Louisiana confirms 11 more fatalities from Hurricane Ida, raising the overall death toll there to 26. According to the Louisiana Department of Health, all the 11 victims were from the city of New Orleans. Nine of them above 60 died from excessive heat during an extended power outage following the storm. Two deaths were also blamed on carbon monoxide poisoning. Ida struck Louisiana as a Category 4 hurricane in late August, destroying many homes and leaving more than a million people without power. It then lashed out the region with heavy rains and flooding on its way north as it weakened into a tropical storm. At least 50 people lost their lives as the remnants of Ida pummeled several northeastern states, including New York and New Jersey. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says time is running out for Iran to, quote, return to the 2015 nuclear deal. He made the remarks after the International Atomic Energy Agency accused Tehran of lack of cooperation. The Syrian army has taken control of a strategic area in the southwestern city of Daraa following a Russian-brokered ceasefire with militants there. The militants are now surrendering their arms to government forces. Our correspondent Mohammed Ali in Damascus is just standing by to tell us more about that. Mohammed, it's good to be able to talk to you at last. Thank you for joining us. Over to you.
Yes, I am now inside Daraa Governorate in southern Syria. I am exactly standing at the entrance of Daraa al-Balad, the area that the Syrian army entered and took control of just 2 days ago following a deal reached with the armed groups inside this quarter. Now, there are thousands of people, civilians, residents, who left Daraa al-Balad about 2 weeks ago when the negotiations failed. They were fearing of the battles that could have could happen inside. So those civilians left 2 weeks ago, and the Syrian government welcomed them in temporary shelters until this deal is reached. Now that the deal is reached, now that security is restored inside and that the armed men have surrendered their weapons and they have reconciled with the Syrian government, the civilians now are going back home. They are coming from Daraa al-Mahatta, the government-controlled part of Daraa. They're coming from there, from government-held parts, and entering into Daraa al-Balad to go back to their homes now that the Syrian army is there and security is restored. The recent developments with regards to this deal is that the Syrian army has established several security checkpoints to ensure security and stability in the future inside Daraa al-Balad. Particularly, there are 9 checkpoints inside. The Syrian army this morning, we accompanied the Syrian army and security forces in raising the Syrian flag also over Al-Minshiyeh police department inside Daraa al-Balad. And this is for the first time happening since the start of the crisis that the Syrian army enters Daraa al-Balad, that institutions, government institutions, enter into Daraa al-Balad in order to refunction again. Now, also just adjacent to Daraa al-Balad is Daraa al-Mahatta, and this is the entrance of Daraa al-Mahatta, where inside there are armed groups who refused reconciliation. Now, what is secured is only Daraa al-Balad, but the area near it, which is al-Mukhayyam, meaning the camp, over there, armed groups that refuse reconciliation are positioned now inside there. We're waiting to see what will happen, if they are going to accept the deal and reconcile, or if not, they will have to leave via buses to Syria's north, because the Syrian government is determined to restore security and stability to all Daraa governorate.
Mohammed, thank you so much for joining us. I've been talking to Mohammed Ali, our correspondent, who was just giving us some information on the latest and the situation on the ground in Dar al-Balad in Syria. And with that, we are going to conclude this edition of World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Gunrunners, directed by Canadian documentary filmmaker Anjali Nayar. And joining me in the studio, we have Lee Singer, who is a film journalist and video essayist, whose work has appeared in various major newspapers, magazines, and online outlets. And beside him is Tete Coffey, who is a journalist and broadcaster. Now, Gunrunners, which is shot over a 10-year period, follows two Kenyan cattle rustlers, who are also known as warriors, Julius Urile and Robert Mitanda, who put their violent past behind them to become marathon runners as part of a government-sponsored program to disarm the conflict-heavy region. We see Urile enter international marathons, while Mitanda gets involved in the political sphere and dreams of working towards policy change. Though as we see these once notorious warriors given a chance to pursue their dreams, we realize that the road to glory is full of bumps and detours for these charismatic men. Well, first of all, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, Kenya is known as a destination for world-class marathon runners, but it's not as glamorous as it seems to be a top athlete in that part of the world, particularly because some of them are quite literally running for their lives, running away from crime. And we see that cattle stealing, or cattle wrestling, as it's called, is quite commonplace because that's an important source of income. And this region is also engulfed in the illegal arms trade industry, which is part of a global multi-billion dollar industry. Lee, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on this documentary?
Well, firstly, it's just a fascinating sort of insight into, you know, a situation that I really did not know much about. You know, I know very well that Kenya is a history of producing great runners. I didn't know about this, you know, pretty fantastic government-run program, this sort of amnesty and the disarmament idea, which is a really great one, and obviously it gives a great film title then, Gunrunners. The film itself, I mean, I think it was shot over 10 years, so you can only imagine how much footage has been accumulated during that time. And I guess, as fascinating as I found the subject and the two principal characters, I felt that in a sort of 90-minute running time, you're kind of skipping big chunks. You know, so much is going on, and I didn't feel that I was getting to know the two men in the way that I would have liked. I mean, basically, I could imagine a longer film that would have it's longer, but you would have felt more in getting into the rhythm of what's going on with these people, because there's so much to say, and they go through so many changes, both of them individually, and I feel 90 minutes doesn't necessarily do justice to everything that's, you know, it's trying to encapsulate.
You're right, it is absolutely jam-packed. It touches on issues of violence, as well as the main themes of sports and running, but then also politics and corruption. There's just so much in this documentary. And Tete, if I could turn to you, what was your take on Gunrunners?
Okay, normally when I'm told about documentaries about Africa, I yawn, roll my eyes and go, oh God, not again. I tend to want to avoid them. I was very pleasantly surprised by this for two reasons. One, it was rich in context, so that whatever was going through the lives of these two, the protagonists, if you like, it was placed within context and it gave you an understanding of the environment from which they came. Secondly, I think it was done with quite a lot of sensitivity. There's little tricks he used in what you call chopping and changing. I mean, cutting from the Rift Valley, training scenes in
which
in
is absolutely
camps,
breathtaking.
Exquisite. In Kenya, over to the skyscrapers of New York. You could see that these are two little people operating in one world, but kind of moving out into a much, much bigger world. And the third thing I really liked about it was that it looks as if these two characters are archetypes. And Urile is very much the superstar, the very talented runner and so on. And his mate, Mitanda, seems to be much more the political type. So how the two characters fare was something I was always watching to see. I was impressed.
I'd like to pick apart their characters a bit later on.
Sure.
Lee, I'd like to ask you, this documentary kind of describes itself as the American dream, but Kenyan style. It's an interesting analogy. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I'm always a bit puzzled by this American dream. I don't understand why, you know, one country has a monopoly on wanting to change your life for the better and improve your situation. I mean, it's a cute tagline. I think it's kind of irrelevant. The fact is, yes, they do go to New York and, you know, run marathons. marathons there, but you know, marathon running is a world global pursuit. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, to me it smacks more of marketing than any sort of reality. Why can't it be a Kenyan dream?
This Saturday marks the first annual Tekla Lerupe Peace Race. Tekla Lerupe, the former marathon world record holder from the conflict region, is partnering with the government to invite cattle rustlers to trade in their weapons in exchange for amnesty and a chance to win cows and cash prizes.
We learn from this film that this amnesty program is quite inspirational. How does it transform the lives of Aurelia Mutanda, Lee?
Well, I mean, you know, until this program comes in, they are very aware that they're living a very precarious, you know, highly dangerous existence, and one that they're very clearly both uncomfortable with. You know, it does involve, they don't answer it directly, but you very much get the sense that they've been involved in deaths. And obviously they've had loved ones or friends die as well. So it's just a really unpleasant, you know, precarious existence. So this government program is really trying to give people a kind of a firmer foothold in, I guess, you know, quote unquote, the right direction. So taking them away from sort of illegal activities, illegal guns, and trying to sort of, you know, push their energies and their sort of, their outlook in a more kind of positive and, peaceful direction. So that's a great thing.
And Tete, the film sheds a positive light on this amnesty program. How effective is it really, and can you talk more a bit about this?
Well, there are a couple of things which come out. For a program to work, you've got to be able to transfer skills which are being adversely used or not constructively used into something which is positive. And in the way the story pans out with these two characters, Mutanda is very much the organizer. I mean, he had 500 effectively gangsters, hoodlums, they call themselves rustlers, under his charge. This guy's a people organizer. Of course, he's the one whose skills are now deployed in the political arena, actually getting people involved with the program, even campaigning for a parliamentary candidate. And he says he himself has parliamentary aspirations. Then Aurelia, on the other hand, is the rising star, the hugely talented individual. They said that even as a kid, he was winning things at the local level. So his skills, his competitive drive is now being, you know, applied in an arena which can actually make him money, improve the quality of his personal life, the life of his family, and so on. And it does say that a lot depends on the quality of government, the environment you provide. These talents are available in bad neighborhoods, and they're available in the right postcodes. The difference is that in the right postcode or a stable environment, those talents are able to flourish because they are positively deployed. So in terms of this gun amnesty, Kenya had a problem. I think it was a blindingly inspired idea. It's one of the funniest quotes I actually picked up from this was he said, well, the skills I need to run I need to be able to run fast to chase cattle, and I need to be run fast to escape the police. And he's doing that in the marathon.
That's exactly the point of this film, is that violence goes hand in hand with their ability to be good athletes. Yeah. And Lee, if I could ask you, an issue that is raised in this documentary is that when you have a gun, you have a sense of power. So it seems as if it's an accepted reality or part of life in Kenya.
There's an amazing quote, and to be honest, it's the thing that probably stayed with me most from this film. I think it's Mutanda he's talking. He's like, you know, if you haven't killed someone, if you haven't stolen their property, then what kind of a warrior are you? And to me, this is really then what they're actually really trying to do underlying is change the whole paradigm of what makes a warrior or actually a man. And actually, that's something that is a huge, that's not just particular to this country. It's something we probably all need to look at in, you know, different societies, the way we construct masculine identity. And it shouldn't be about trying to dominate and power and, you know, impose yourself. And I think actually they don't explore that anymore, sadly, I felt in this. Mm. But the fact that he vocalizes it shows that actually it's making him reconsider what, you know, as a warrior he should be doing. And then the fact that he goes into more sort of, you know, political and sort of socially constructive things is obviously helping that situation.
When I was in the bush, I used to run. That's why when I came here, I didn't find it difficult when I started to run, because I was running even 100 kilometers. You know, when the police is chasing you, also you chase the cattle. So you chase very fast, but if you chase very slowly, the police will capture you, and then you'll be in a hot soup.
I found both characters to be quite endearing, but I think Matanda was the more charismatic one out of the two. And we get the sense that he had a much darker past than Arile. There was a moment when he was asked how many people he's killed, and he just looks off camera and remains silent, which is quite chilling to watch. Lee, what did you make of Matanda's character compared to Arile's?
Yeah, I mean, one of the strengths of the film is that they are very different. So you have that immediate contrast. And Tete's, you know, described it very well. Matanda's the sort of more social, you know, political animal. He has a natural ability and affinity to kind of, you know, draw people in. Arile is much more kind of, you know, quieter, more sort of focused on his own sort of goals. And so that, I think, is one of the main strengths of the film, because as you follow their paths, you find that actually they diverge more than you might expect, because actually they aren't equally talented runners. So then one storyline really pursues the actual running side of it, and the other goes, I would say, into equally or maybe more interesting avenues about, well, if you can't do that, it's not just, you know, guns or running. Actually, if the running is not going to be your career, you can use your skills in different ways, and I think that's a very interesting.
And we see Matanda pursue politics, but then of course we learned that it seems to be a corrupt world, and it's almost he embraces it and talks about it openly. Tete, is this a reality of life in Kenya?
It's a reality of life in Kenya, and not just Kenya, a lot of African countries. It's also the reality of life over here, but it's because there's a lot more wealth, and because ordinary people's needs are taken care of on a day-to-day basis, you don't see it as starkly. But in Kenya, it's very clear. I mean, he threatens the politician that if you don't make me, you know, minister in charge of security, which he patently won't be able to hold, he wouldn't be able to hold that position. He said he'd mobilize things against him. And what it says to me is that these individual talents are kind of drawn into this prism of organization, be it the sport, be it politics, be it whatever. And it is the quality of the organization that can absolutely, you know, enable them or absolutely destroy them.
Mm-hmm. And I want to touch quickly on the point about guns. We find out from in this documentary also that there's 500,000 illegal guns in Kenya. I mean, mm-hmm. Where are they coming from and why are they there?
Well, I mean, there was a breakup of the Soviet Union, and that led to a huge kind of splurge of small arms all over the world. And, of course, these things are what are required to create kind of little lordships in all of these different countries. And it is one of the saddest statistics of African life that where there are the greatest resources, you have the greatest conflict. So a country like the Congo, which is incredibly wealthy, has had internecine strife for near on 40 years consecutively. Of course, while that happens, the natives can't benefit from the resources in their land, but other agents do. And unfortunately, it is often foreign agents who enable these weapons to get into the hands of these people. And so that it's almost a system of divide and rule. Mm. But of course, you know, if you're a politician in Africa and you're accepting bribes from foreign agents to create conflict and strife in your own country, that's a decision only you can make. Nobody holds a gun to your head to do that. So it comes to issues around personal integrity and so on and so forth.
That's a really interesting point, but I'm afraid we'll have to move on just for the time being.
Dream about my future. Mostly I dream about money. I will build this, I will build that, many things like that.
My name is Julius Arile from Kenya. 6 years ago, being a warrior, fighting with another people from our country. But this time now, I am an athlete and I can run a marathon.
He really does need to make a breakthrough. And if he doesn't have it, then it's going to be harder to fulfill this kind of dream of being an New York as an elite, top elite athlete that could maybe make it in the top five.
Good morning and welcome to Prague, Czech Republic, for the 19th running of the Volkswagen Prague Marathon.
A great race starting across Old Town Square in this historic city.
So really very much the underdog character in this documentary, and you really find yourself rooting for him. He has a lot of pressure on himself to prove himself, and he dreams of being on the wall, as he says, of all the top runners of Kenya. And we see him come seventh place in the first race, and then, but then do really well in the second opportunity he has. What did you make of this sort of triumphant arc he had?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I guess when you're choosing your characters to focus on at the beginning of a journey, you have no idea, actually, are they going to make it and stuff. So I think it's less, it sounds a cliche, but it's less about the destination than the journey. It's fascinating to follow this particular man on his sort of athletics career. Now, if he, you know, ends up winning a gold medal at the Olympics, even more extraordinary. But actually, I find it more interesting when you see the real struggles and the person who isn't necessarily going to be the ultimate victor in this. The film really made me think about an American documentary called Hoop Dreams from the 1990s, which followed two young inner-city kids who wanted to be basketball stars. Now, neither of them end up making it, but what you get is a fascinating portrait of their environment and the world that they're in and the politics and the social disadvantages, and actually, that's a more illuminating and, I think, more fascinating storyline than just, you know, the underdog who comes from nowhere to, you know, in the last minute, you know, storms to the front and wins the medal. That's interesting, but I'm more interested in the sort of the world that shapes their, you know.
Of course, he's plagued by poverty and injuries and not the same opportunities. Tete, so are you agreeing with Lee there?
Yeah, but absolutely, the journey's fascinating. And none of these characters are pristine. Got somebody pregnant when she was quite young. It led to her suicide and led to him becoming a warrior. But later on, he's now got three wives with and children by all of them. So if he's not able to take that, put each one of his problems in some kind of compartment, he won't be able to pursue his dream. So these dreams are always fraught. And actually, the story, as you say very well, is the compromises, you know, the calls that each person has to make to pursue what it is that they're really after, and an illumination of the environment within which all of this is going on.
I want to talk now about the parallels we see between Kenya and the US, sort of the Western world. Lee, what did you make of their journey, of Relay's journey to New York, and sort of the observations and comments he was making?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's very much sort of fish out of water stuff, right? So, you know, where they've grown up, where they live, what they're used to is obviously a world away from, you know, the slightly, you know, more glamorous, the more professional, the more kind of money at stake world that they go into. But I think, again, what's really interesting is in their own world as well, you see the way that they're not quite fitting in and the problems that they have. And to be honest, I would have liked the film to touch more on that. Like Tete says, they have these very checkered family lives. That's not really grappled with in the way that I would have, you know, appreciated a bit more. Mm-hmm. And I feel that, you know, of course the thread is the running and the marathon and what happens, but actually to get to know them even a bit more as characters and get a sort of a more rounded portrait of them, I would have liked to hear more about those sort of difficulties with the families and the wives and the kids, mm-hmm. because it obviously has an impact. He wants to earn money so he can go back mm-hmm. and provide for them, but we don't necessarily get, you know, the full story about what that entails.
And Tete, isn't it quite sad, though, that this notion of success, we see Arile move to sort of a shack-like accommodation, and he thinks he's living in a European city. Why is that this connection of success is linked to Europe and the West?
Well, success is always relative to what you've got. I mean, this guy wasn't having three baths a week out in the bush, and he's suddenly in a shack with running water. I mean, that's luxury. He might as well, from his point of view, be at the Ritz Hotel. It's absolutely relative. But what I think it's important for people to also think about is the fact that this can be quite corrupting. This kind of drive to live in that star-spangled environment can be quite corrupting, because we all know that the industry that he's now becoming a part of, the elite athletics industry, is also incredibly corrupt.
Which is mainly dominated, sort of, as we see, by Western physiotherapists and management types.
So it's incredibly corrupt. So It's really a story about how, you know, man has to try and make it, making moral judgments at every turn of the way in a not so easy world.
I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there, gentlemen. Thank you very much for joining Doc Review. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camilla Shambiati.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Muharram, time so of sadness happened.
As-salamu ala ba'ayk, ya Aba Abdullah.
Wa innama kharajtu li talab al-islah fi ummati jaddi sallallahu alayhi wa alihi.
The words of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam in dialogue.
Sallallahu alayk, ya Aba Abdullah.
casting gloom on Karbala.
Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the son of the Lady of Light, the esteemed Fatima, the son of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali, the grandson of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the beacon of light which guides towards piety and purity, the one who has beautifully said, "The most forgiving person is the one who forgives when in a position of power and strength." Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the master of martyrs, these are his words. Imam al-Hussein's words in response to Muhammad bin al-Hanafiyya.
قال الإمام الحسين عليه السلام بلى ولكن بعدما فارقتك أتاني رسول الله صلى الله عليه وآله وقال يا حسين اخرج فإن الله تعالى شاء أن يراك قتيلا وقد شاء الله أن يراهن سبايا.
Yes, but after I got separated from you, the Prophet of Allah, may Allah bestow his blessings upon him and his progeny, came to my dream and said, O Hussein, get out, for Allah the Almighty wishes to see you slain, and Allah wishes to see them as captives.
السلام عليك يا أسير الكربات السلام عليك يا السلام عليك يا أسير الكربات ويا قتيل العبرات السلام عليك يا أسير الكربات ويا قتيل العبرات أترجو أمتي قتلت حسينا شفاعة جده يوم الحساب السلام على الخد التريب.
And now let's listen to Dr. Muhammad Reza Fakhr al-Ruhani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sallallahu alayhi wa abdullah. Soon after his conversation with Abdullah ibn Zubayr, again Muhammad ibn al-Hanafiyya came forward and intended to discourage Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, because as indicated before, all people were informed of the martyrdom fate of Imam al-Hussein based on prophetic anticipations. Then Imam al-Hussein answered his younger stepbrother, Muhammad ibn al-Hanafiyya, in that he had a true revelatory dream, in that the Prophet Muhammad recommended Imam al-Hussein to leave Mecca because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala intended to see Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam a martyr. And then he indicated that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala intended to find the peers of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, his close relatives and family members, to be captivated. Please note that both the tragic martyrdom, tragic and heartrending martyrdom of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, and the captivity of the Karbala survivors, though very much painful and unbearable, we find that, this kind of calamity later on in Islamic history made a loudspeaker of the voice of the Ahl al-Bayt. Imagine that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam had gone to Karbala alone. Certainly, after his martyrdom over there, the Umayyad hegemony would finish everything without letting any piece of single news reach out of the plain of Karbala elsewhere. However, we find that in the case of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam's departure from Mecca to Karbala, in fact, his leaving Mecca for Karbala, for Al-Kufa, and his martyrdom in Al-Karbala, formed a turning point in the Islamic history. The important part of this turning point in the Islamic history was simply that the close relatives of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and his family members were taken as captives and prisoners of war from Karbala, first to Al-Kufa, then to Damascus, and then they were returned back to Medina. And all of these incidents pictured the sinister character of the Umayyad hegemony at that time. Sallallahu alayki ya Aba Abdullah.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of the program Dialogue. We hope that you remain under the auspicious grace of Imam Hussein today and always.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.